Ladies and gentlemen, over there is the countenance that is Walter Sabo. Hello, Walter. Also known on the air as Walter Sterling.
Alex, it is an honor to be with you. I am humbled to be on with you because you were nominated to be in the Radio Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And that happens to be a very big deal because I'm on the nominating committee, as are many others. And when your name came up, it was probably for me, when the name came up, Alex Bennett, what was interesting is that not one person on that committee of 20 raised any objection at all. It was instantly, oh, yes, of course. And you were instantly nominated.
Wow, that's very nice. I'd like to say it's a pleasure to be nominated, but it'd be more of a pleasure to have won. But anyway,
it's a complex voting system. So the nomination is a win.
The nomination is a win. Okay. Well, I can call myself a Radio Hall of Fame nominee Alex Bennett then, right?
I would.
Yeah. I don't like those things when they turn into a contest, you know? I mean, I don't think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is in your neck of the woods, does not take an audience vote in order to determine it.
One slot is an audience vote.
Okay.
But I don't like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because, tragically, I know who runs that that voting, who runs that competition. It's not the museum. It's not the museum. Mm-hmm. It's a bunch of guys in New York and who have nothing to do with the museum, and the museum has nothing to do with the Hall of Fame nominees and inductees. And it is heavily, heavily weighted in favor of fans of The Who.
I love that. Fans of The Who.
Heavily weighted in favor of fans of Jimmy Page, the sacred Jimmy Page.
Yeah.
Dionne Warwick is not on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Please explain to me how that is possible.
Well, isn't there, who else? There was somebody else they mentioned that was, I guess this year, they have for the, you know, that one slot or whatever, a whole bunch of nominees. And I'm going, why haven't all of those people already been inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame or the Music Hall of Fame? Now, I know that the Sports Hall of Fame is voted upon by sports writers. Okay? That makes a little more sense. I just don't like it when they turn it into a contest. Oh, the public should vote here, you know? No, I mean, the public, for instance, if you do a public vote on the Radio Hall of Fame, doesn't know who the hell Alex Bennett is unless they're from San Francisco or New York, you know? But if there's somebody that's syndicated, they're better known.
You know. A fact. It's a total fact.
Right. Now, when you say you're going to put somebody in the Radio Hall of Fame, I would say, who are you putting in and what did they contribute to the overall history of broadcasting?
So when names come up and I'm on the nominating committee, and I'm not saying my judgment is sacred, but this is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Is that I always stop them if, like, they've spent 50 years on the air in Philadelphia. I say this is a national Radio Hall of Fame. It should not be based on one, you know, being a success in one market. In other words, to me, they did their job. If they're a success in one market, they did their job. And what I pointed out with you were the number of cities you were in and the number of formats that you were in. I said he was in three distinct formats in like five or six cities. He was a winner in every city. That's a National Radio Hall of Fame nominee. That's where it makes sense. But some guys, you know, who have been 40 years in Philadelphia, waking up Philadelphia, to me it's like, oh, so they did their job.
Well, that's who won.
That's nice, but there's a Philadelphia Hall of Fame. There's a Pennsylvania Hall of Fame. Yeah. Keep them there.
Well, the guys who won this year were at the morning show in Philadelphia, right?
It started a fight.
What do you mean it started a fight?
I said, what are we doing?
Oh, that's the one that you were referring to then.
Yeah, but it happens every year. You know, it happens every year.
Yeah.
Unless in that city they broke ground. They did something that had never been done before and therefore was copied endlessly. That's different.
If I'm not mistaken, it took them many years to nominate Howard Stern, long after he was well known nationally.
Yes, and his opinion was, and I agreed with it, and I wasn't on the committee then, but when it started, his opinion was, "There, it is not a Radio Hall of Fame unless I'm in it." And he was right.
And he's right.
And he should have been in the first class. He said, "Find me somebody more successful than me in history." And his objectively, he was right.
Well, he was right. I mean, I can think of people, for instance, that should be in the Hall of Fame. I don't think the name Don Sherwood is there, who is perhaps one of the...
It is.
It is in the Hall of Fame? Okay, good. Good. Yeah. You know, because there are certain people that are legendary in their markets because, you know, before syndication, you only stayed in one market if you were successful, and you own that market. And so you really have to go back to those people, too, you know.
What was interesting in the Don Sherwood era...
Mm-hmm. Don Sherwood, only, by the way, let me tell people who don't know, Don Sherwood was in San Francisco doing mornings at KSFO, and perhaps in my mind, the most successful single broadcaster in any market in the United States.
And yet, if you asked his son, what did he do?
Mm-hmm.
His son would tell you, if you heard him now, you would say he didn't do very much.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, you know, slap on the back, neighbor over the fence, but nothing really that cutting edge. It was just consistently perfect for that moment in time. And he, but at that moment in time, and it was really interesting, you said if they were successful in that market, in a given market,
mm-hmm.
inevitably, if their success caught people's attention in other cities and they moved to another city, mm-hmm. inevitably they fail. It was all about a single act at mm-hmm. a single moment in time in a specific city. Many, many towns.
Oh, he was San Francisco.
Yes, he was.
He oozed San Francisco. But I would disagree with his son. I think there was more to Don Sherwood than that. I was a big fan. Oh, there goes robocall. Anyway, yours just went off, too.
Yes, but I know it's not a real call.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, Don Sherwood, I think, was more than that. I was a fan, and he was an influence on me on how you do radio. In fact, he was nice enough. Once I wrote him and I said, "I would love to come down and see your radio show. I'm such a big fan and I want to be in radio and blah, 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 blah." And he invited me down and I sat there in the studio with him while he was doing his show.
That's a score.
Yeah. That's how big a fan I was of his. And he had a lot of influence on me. And what that influence was is that Don Sherwood brought into the studio what he witnessed and felt on the street. Okay, his life came into that studio, and then he talked about his life, you know, and that was the element of my act that, you know, that I got from Sherwood, is that it's very important to talk about yourself, that the prep for your show isn't sitting down and reading newspapers and doing this and jotting this down and saying, "I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that." It's the life you live every day, and then when you walk into that studio, you bring it in with you. So
I agree.
I think he had more substance than his son says.
I agree, and I try to do that with my show. Think about all the big syndicated acts today,
yeah.
And how little you know about their life. How do they have a cat, a dog? What are the names of the children? You don't know.
You don't know.
You don't know. And why would I buy an Acura from somebody who's names I don't know? I mean, that's what they're doing. They're doing live reads, and I don't know who the hell they are. So I also find that it sets up, if you do it right, it sets up the power of the mirror. And there's nothing more powerful than talking to someone about themselves, mm-hmm. which you can do if you talk about yourself honestly. So what do I talk about? I talk about the fact that my kid has apraxia, But I do more than that. I have her come on the air with me and review, what's the name of the show where people open up storage lockers and go through
this stuff? Storage Wars.
Yeah. So I watch Storage Wars with my 9-year-old, mm-hmm. and then I put her on with me, and I say, let's talk about that show. Do you like those people? No, I think they're inappropriate. Do you like the stuff they find? No, it looks terrible. So she talks about Storage Wars, and then she cheered off, and she said, that show you watch where everything they say is beep, that one, the beep on the boat, yeah. I mean, I said, you mean Below Deck Mediterranean? She says, yeah, very inappropriate, she says, but she does it with a speech impediment. And so she's very entertaining. And I talk about the fact that we have 3 cats. My wife hates the cats. And then my biggest challenge in life is the check engine light has never gone off. In my car, the check engine light has never gone off. And we're up to about $3,000 to get the check engine light to go off.
And you take the car in and they fix it and everything, right? They do what they have to do.
Multiple times, multiple
garages.
Well,
then they're supposed to turn off the check engine light.
Right. The problem with them turning off the check engine light is that will last, if they don't make the repair, that'll last about a day. And if you go to a good inspection station and they stick the thing in your car, they know what you've done. Mm-hmm. They say, did you just have this fixed? And I go, oh, no. Well, there's something wrong with this. And then the next day it goes back on. And I can't get it inspected until the check engine light goes off.
No, really?
Really.
I thought that check engine light was like, it was there as a service to the driver. It's time to check your engine or whatever.
But I don't feel served.
Well, they never denied me a new license for my car or whatever because my check engine light was on.
Yeah. In Ohio, they will not give you, even before, when I pull in, they look at my dash and say, you will not pass if one of those lights is on. That's it.
So how do you get your car to pass?
It doesn't. Now, the gift of the epidemic, mm-hmm. is that the government of Ohio is looking the other way for all of those infractions. They're like, we know you can't get your car fixed at this time. We know it's hard to get it inspected. They're just not looking. But that's going to end very soon. Like the next time I'm stopped, it will end.
Yeah. Wow.
I hate owning a car, by the way. My favorite car is the 4, 5, or 6. That's my favorite car. And I've never had a better car than the 4, 5, or 6.
What do you mean the 4, 5, or 6?
What's it called? The big brand is Subway. That's my favorite car.
Oh, Subway. Oh, I see.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I hate owning a car. I don't have good car karma. All my life, my cars break down. All my life. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest waste of money for me. I know there are car people, people who enjoy owning a car, but not me.
You didn't own a car when you lived in New York, did you?
My current wife, because she grew up in Ohio and because we had kids, wanted a minivan. I said, you don't understand how much waste this is going to be involving. This will be $600 a month for the garage or worse, thousands of hours circling blocks, going way to the west side, parking it on a pier. You have no idea. And then if it breaks down, God help you.
And she was from Ohio. So she came here and then she was, well, you know, when I first came here years ago, I owned a car in New York. A couple of reasons why. I was a California kid. I had to have a car.
Right.
You know, and as years have gone on, I finally, when I came out here the next time, I went, well, I sold my car in California, and I don't think I'm going to get a car. And I really haven't missed having a car. But
right.
The problem is I also don't leave Manhattan very often either.
No.
You know.
No, the other problem is that the expense of owning a car is outmatched by the expense of renting a car in Manhattan. It's crazy what they charge.
Well, renting a car was reasonable a few years ago when I rented my last one. I go to Hertz, I get it for the weekend, it would cost me about $200. I finally decided you don't do the weekend, because if you do a whole week, it's cheaper than if you do 3 days. So what we were going to do the next time was rent it for a week and then go where we go for 3 days and then travel around for a while. But anyway, the point is that I've never had a reason to own a car in New York because exactly what you say. To begin with, you got to pay for the car. Maybe you're making payments on that car. Then you got to then you have to once you're making the payments, you have to get the insurance, which is much more expensive in New York City than it is at anywhere in the United States. I don't even know how much it is anymore, but I'm sure it amounts to several hundred dollars a month. All right.
It was $400 a month when I had a car.
In New York. Okay, $400 a month. Then you've got the parking, which, as you say, is anywhere between $400 and $600 a month.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, and then you don't use it because you live in Manhattan and you take a subway or a Lyft or whatever. You don't drive down somewhere because then you have to find a parking space or you have to put it in a garage at $50 an hour, you know. So, I mean, so here's what happened. So I haven't had a car. So then COVID comes along. And the last time we used a car was about 4 years ago when we drove up to Vermont. I have this feeling I don't know how to drive anymore. I fear it. You know, getting into a car and this big thing, I am trying to negotiate around. So I don't know whether I can drive any longer.
Now, the good news for you is because of where you live and because I have visited you and I have driven to where you are, two blocks away from you is a $10 a day garage.
But remember, that's $300 a week.
I'm saying for a day. If somebody came to visit you or you rented a car and you needed to park it, it's $10 a day on 104th Street.
104th Street. Okay.
Block east. And the and it's a good garage. So it's nice that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that out-of-towners from New York can't even believe is a parking ticket in Manhattan or Brooklyn starts at $100.
Does it really?
Oh, it starts at $100 and gets worse from there. But you're not going to pay less than $100. And then, if by some magic you get towed, let me tell you where you get towed. You get towed to a scary hurricane fenced-in parking lot in Brooklyn that is ingeniously at the edge of the river. So one side is the fence, the other side is the river. So you're not going to get that car out of there. By magic, and oh gee, the giant dog is near your car, so it's terrifying to retrieve your car.
Well, the thing is that they used to have the towing place was down at the bottom of 57th Street.
Yeah, that's for rich people. You're going to be towed to Brooklyn.
Well, I'm not being towed anywhere because I don't have a car. Okay, you know. But we're getting back to what we were talking about. This is exactly the kind of thing that you talk about and I talk about. But I find that my problem has been since COVID. I have nothing to talk about because I'm basically in the house all the time, you know. And I don't have any kids to bring on to talk about TV shows. So I find I've been robbed of my essence by not having much of a life experience going on right now.
Well, what I did with that, and you're welcome to borrow, is I talked about the fact that finally the rest of society has caught up to my fantasy, which is to sit in a very comfortable chair all day and watch episode after episode of any given TV show that I'm obsessed with now.
Mm-hmm.
So I, when this hit, I was in heaven. I'm like, oh, finally I don't have to go outside. Finally I don't have to pretend to be active. I can just sit here and I'm doing good deed. It's like jury duty. I can just sit here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of the few people who has never complained about jury duty because to me it seemed like an ideal way to pay the day. I can sit. Everybody thinks I'm doing something normal.
Mm-hmm.
Over there is Chinatown. At lunch, I go to Chinatown. I couldn't be happier than to go to Chinatown.
Yeah.
And then I go home, and everybody goes, oh, Walter, it must be terrible to have to do jury duty. And I go, oh, yes, it's so terrible.
You were talking about binging old TV shows. You know what I've been binging lately is Hot in Cleveland.
Isn't that a great show?
It's a great show. I missed it completely the first time around.
You know what else is amazing is on the same YouTube menu are the original What's My Lines.
Yeah.
And you see a very different world from 1950, 51, right. 52 of people who are on What's My Line and how that show was hosted. And John Daly treated each of those panelists as though they were the king of England. They were deferred to, respected, and, to have Bennett Cerf sitting there. People don't realize who Bennett Cerf was. He wasn't, like, running Random House. He was the founder of Random House. Yeah. Random House was his idea. And then he took 3 hours off a week to go on this TV show, which, by the way, do you know where that was shot?
Where?
It was shot on the upper floor, the mezzanine floor at Grand Central Station. That's where they
shot. Yes, that's where the CBS studios were originally.
Right. How cool is that?
Yeah. You don't get the feeling they're on the mezzanine floor. It's not like they used the view from the mezzanine as a background or anything. Today they would, by the way.
Today they would. They must have then felt that it was they were ashamed to not have a proper studio.
Yeah.
That NBC was at 30 Rock with real studios. It must have been embarrassed.
Well, people don't realize originally the major studios that they used for NBC were in Brooklyn.
Right.
Yeah. You know. Right. And to this day, some of the soaps are still done there. You know. Brooklyn? TV studio in Brooklyn?
Right. You know.
But we went from Don Sherwood to talking about life experiences. But as I was saying, I find that I don't have as much to talk about because before I could kind of talk about the adventures of Alex Bennett. Right. And, today I went to here and this happened and I went to the dentist. And there's not that much that I have to talk about lately. Or maybe it's just...
You go outside now, right? You go outside.
No, I don't.
Really?
No, I mean, I'm about ready to venture out there again because we've given the all clear signal that things are not very bad here in New York. But, you know, as somebody who's 82 years old, you know, this whole COVID thing scared the shit out of me. You know?
You were right to be scared, and you were right to stay inside, and you were right to take care of yourself because that's why you're here.
Yeah.
You know, your governor wasn't going to take care of you. And it was handled poorly on all fronts. But as I say to anybody who will listen to me, I say, none of these people in charge wanted anyone to die. Yeah. None of them had any experience with a pandemic. They did their best.
Right.
You know, nobody wanted anyone to die.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm kind of, I've been indoors a lot. And I probably should go back out. It's winter now, though, and it's cold, so
Horrible. My
walks are not appropriate, you know. So,
what series have you been binging? Do you remember
Hot in Cleveland, that's about it. I mean, come on, there's 6 seasons of that, 156 episodes.
That's right. The other, you know, and I love that Storage Wars. I love that Storage Wars.
Really? Well, I love Below Deck Mediterranean.
Brilliant. The way I explain it to friends, I say, you have to understand what it is. This is a show about Australian high school dropouts wearing uniforms that are too tight who don't know where to put the fork on a place setting. And that's a whole hour.
Yeah, that's
a whole hour.
The Mediterranean one I just like best because the women are kind of more attractive. And it's just the whole thing. But what it is...
Well, you know why they're more attractive, don't you? There's a reason.
Why?
The captain is a lesbian. And she's very picky about who shares her bunk. So now she has a crew of Australians.
How do you know she's a lesbian? Has it been stated she's a lesbian?
Yeah, I think they actually showed the wedding.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
So she's a lesbian, or as I would say in the air, a known lesbian.
A known lesbian.
She's a known lesbian. But the kids are high school dropouts from Australia, so they've got those great accents that are automatically sexy, and they don't know anything. So you can tell them anything, and they'll think, it's a good idea, bad idea, I'll have another drink. It's a great show. And then I found out what it takes to make that show. they have 400 people in the production staff to make that show. That's how many hotel rooms they have to get. And one of the staterooms on those yachts is the control room.
Control room, yeah. That's what I've heard.
So they have a control room on that boat, and it's brilliant. And it must cost for Bravo a freaking
fortune. Well, they have to rent out the boat, don't they? Or how about the people who rent? We're going to go over, folks. This is going to be a longer than usual interview because I love the conversation.
The people on the boat, do they pay half of what they would normally pay?
I see. Okay. All right. And they agree to be on camera.
They're thrilled.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the company pays for the rest of the boat. So that's got to be an expensive proposition. How much does that boat go for a week or something?
Depending on what I've read, it's $350,000
or $400,000. Oh, Jesus. So that's not a cheap show to produce. That's not like your normal reality show where, you know, they go into a home owned by a housewife of Cincinnati or something and, you know.
Not to mention the fact that think about the show. I don't see any product placement in that show. So the only way they can offset that course cost is with people online subscribing or ads.
Yeah. For some reason, a lot of people who I know, my friend Shecky, for instance, they all watch Below Deck Mediterranean. Or Below Deck, whatever. You know, they have several Below Decks. I like the Mediterranean one best.
Yeah, me too. They have Below Deck Mediterranean, Below Deck Sailing Yacht, and I don't remember the other one.
Yeah. Perhaps there will become a whole Below Deck network. It's kind of like MSNBC on weekends has become the Shark Tank network. It's like Shark Tank all weekend long.
Good decision.
Yeah. Another kind of show I always watch.
Those guys, yes, brilliant show. Those guys get paid $35,000 an episode, each of the sharks.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need the money. But they each get paid $35,000. And as Robert Herjavec says, you have to understand, Mark Cuban can buy and sell all of us 10 times over.
Yeah.
You know, he's just crazy rich.
Yeah, yeah. But that's a great show because, again, I call it what I call it is a potato chip show. You just start eating it and eating it and eating it, and you got to eat some more. You got to eat some more. And yet it takes no work to eat them, you know,
right. And
no investment. Right. You just lie there and let it waft over you, and then it's on to somebody else with some stupid thing he's trying to sell. And, you know, you listen to them and you go, I wouldn't buy that. And then they argue over it. It's a perfect show for vegging. You know?
Yeah, and you can stop and start at
really?
Any time.
Really? There's another robocall.
But the other thing about it is, and my kids and I have figured this out, each shark has a type of person they are inclined to give money to.
Mm-hmm.
So Mark Cuban really likes 22-year-old fierce young men. Who go door to door to sell their idea. He loves that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Barbara Corcoran likes entrepreneurs who have given up everything, lost everything, and have no place else to go. She loves that.
Right.
And Robert Herjavec has a suspicious tendency toward women of a certain age who are very attractive.
Yeah.
He likes that. So they each have a tendency.
Wow. Well, listen, we're running out of time here.
Thank you, Alex.
And I love talking with you, you know. It's always a great pleasure.
It's a great pleasure for me. I want to tell your viewer one thing, which is that when you were on the radio in New York during the Kent State protests and the Kent State shootings, your fierce, honest anger on the air all night on WMCA during that period was breathtaking. It was setting the bar in ways that had never been set before. It was establishing authenticity from a host we had never heard before. And people like Howard Stern have often commented on those shows. He heard those shows, too. It was remarkable radio, and I will forever be grateful to you for being able to hear that.
And can I say that when I was doing them, I didn't realize I was doing anything. I was just being me.
You were channeling what you needed to channel.
Hey, stay where you are when we're through here. I want to talk to you for a second. And okay. That's Walter Sabo, ladies and gentlemen. He knows Walter Sterling. He can be heard across the country on Sunday nights. I know starting here in New York about 10 o'clock, something like that.
10 to 1 Eastern.
Right. And you should listen to him. He's also kind of part of the history of radio, I hate to say. Anyway, I don't want to make you that old. Anyway, thanks, Walter. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Now, in its 11th year, this is GabNet. Talk like you've never heard it before.
Yes, that's Walter Sabo, also known as Walter Sterling, and he said you can hear him on weekends, on Sundays. I think you can also hear him every day, Monday through Friday, at least in Philadelphia, and it could be well elsewhere as well, but I don't have the list right here right now. But that's an old interview, and I like him a lot, and I play it every time I want to feel good about myself. Okay, anyway. Gee, we only got one person waiting to come on tonight. Well, okay, what the hell? Why not? You know, it's just Josh Wheeler. And we'll have him join us here if he can. All righty, here we go. There's Josh Wheeler. Hello, Josh. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Okay, well, we'll let Alan join us here. Okay. All righty. There he is. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Alex.
I have nothing I want to talk about. Anybody here have something they want to talk about?
I don't know. How about the Dodgers today stopped ICE from invading their stadium?
Yeah, they wouldn't let them go into their stadium at all. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Hooray for the Dodgers! Good for them.
When I heard the news, it actually wasn't the Dodgers team or the owner. It was the National or the Major League Baseball, I guess.
Major League Baseball. Okay.
Organization stopped them. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Good. It's about time somebody stopped them. Hello there, Tom Yamaguchi.
Hi there.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I never heard that interview before. It was really interesting. I don't know if you want to talk about it or not, but
well, sure. I play a lot of old interviews on Thursdays, basically because I'm too lazy to record new ones. But anyway,
it was interesting when you were talking about about cars and having cars in New York. Because I've been meaning to ask you what you actually think about the congestion pricing that's been going on in New York.
Well, obviously, on one hand, I shouldn't have an opinion because I don't have a car, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it costs me more to take an Uber or a Lyft because they have to pay that congestion pricing to go past a certain point and on the island. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm against it.
Oh, okay.
You know, and also what it did was because it only applies to people who are coming through the tunnels, doesn't apply to people who are coming across the bridge, the George Washington Bridge, although they've had to pay a lot of high charges for a long time now. But what happens is people come up above Manhattan through the George Washington Bridge, then park their cars uptown. And then they take the subways downtown. Mm-hmm. Okay? So what do you think that does to my neighborhood?
You got a lot of cars.
I have a hard time finding a parking place here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
But in exchange for the fact that it's cost you more to take an Uber downtown, is the ride faster?
I haven't noticed that it's been significantly faster than it was. You know, I've asked cab drivers if it has improved traffic, and they say not really, no. You know.
That's interesting. Because that's different from what I have been hearing from other sources.
And they say they're going to give all that money they make to the subways to improve them, but so far they haven't gotten any better.
Okay.
They said that once before when they were doing something else. I can't remember when it was, you know. They were going to give the money to the subways, and the subways are going to be so much better. They're not.
Well, in philosophy, I certainly like it. And in fact, I just finally finished reading a book that I've been wanting to read for years called The High Cost of Free Parking. It's written by a guy who actually just died earlier this year, Donald Shoup. And he makes some great arguments of why we should be charging for street parking.
Well, we do charge for street parking. Everywhere in Manhattan, you've got meters.
But there's a lot of places that charge, don't actually have it for free. And he's arguing that actually not only just having charging, but charging at different rates depending on how congested a place is. And then using that money to benefit the area.
They always say they're going to do it to benefit the area or to improve the subways, and they never do. Mm-hmm. You know? They just collect the money. That's all. You know? And they put it into the coffers of the city in general rather than saying we're earmarking it to this.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wish that were true.
Okay.
You know? I think that it's terrible. I mean, I remember the days where, you know, there were no parking meters. You know, you could maybe if you parked somewhere, you could only park for an hour or whatever.
Yeah.
But there weren't parking meters. Parking meters came into being, so they make some extra money, you know. And then giving tickets out is a major economic part of the city in which you live. I mean, They charge you for parking, and they charge you for speeding or your meter running out or whatever, and all that money is then put into the city coffers, and that's how most cities are pay for a lot of their stuff, you know. So
okay,
it's,
all right, well,
you know,
that his philosophy is that you create specific districts that benefit from the money. So, but Your arguments are well taken.
Well, I think that if what he says were true, I would go along with it. But quite frankly, I don't think, you know, that there's a lot of money being given back to those various things. You know, I'd like to see the subways get better, okay?
Yeah,
but they haven't. So that's the problem we got, you know.
Okay.
So anyway. You don't have anything like congestion pricing down there where you are, Josh, right?
We go along with it.
We don't have that. I mean, it's incredibly over congested in certain areas.
Tom Yamaguchi.
But they're not charging any kind of
Josh Wheeler.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Jeff is trying to get rid of us. I think he has.
I like where he looks up in the sky.
Oh, thank God.
Somebody's looking down on you.
Yeah, thank God.
Right. My issue would be, they take that money or whatever and are going to do the improvements, which is fine, but they take so long to do them. I mean, it's, you know, ridiculous. I mean, we just stayed, like I said, for a couple of days in Nashville, and right next to the hotel, we had to go around a different way because the exit off of the freeway was closed, so that one half side of the street was closed, and just this little spot, like the exit from the freeway and this small part of the street, and I don't know, you know, what they were doing because we're not from there, but the sign said that it was going to remain closed until June of 2027. And I don't know how long it's been closed. And I look at things like that and I say, what could they be doing to that little area that takes 2 years, over 2 years? I don't understand what kind of road repair takes over 2 years. I don't get it. I mean, that's my problem with all the infrastructure projects in America is they take forever. I mean, you know, they don't work on most of them 24 hours a day. You know, and they drag them out over and over and over. I mean, I don't know. It's just, so like, if they are going to redo some of the subway stuff in New York, I'm sure that would be fine. I'm sure you would love to have like remodeled stations and, you know, different tracks and
improved cars, new cars.
The problem is it'll be people enjoying it like 20 years from now because they take forever to do it.
Well, on top of that, I mean, it's not like we suddenly have this wonderful thing going on here, you know? It's not like you suddenly get on the subways and they're cleaner and nicer and brighter and, you know, move faster and whatever. You know, the subways have always been, well, to begin with, they're underground. So what do you expect, you know? Underground is never nice.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess maybe it would be better if they tried to do some small things that you could at least see like immediate improvement while you were waiting on, you know, the longer term stuff or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. No, not going to happen. Not going to happen.
In that light, I'd like to recommend this book called Abundance by Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, where he talks about how a lot of projects like that just go on and on. He mentions, of course, our high-speed rail here in California.
Oh, yeah.
So many roadblocks are put up, legal roadblocks, from, well, what's known as CEQA, the Environmental Quality Act, California Environmental Quality Act, that has been abused and has prevented things like transportation projects, housing. Mm-hmm. What it was originally meant to, you know, deal with things like toxic waste. And so I would suggest you read that book because I think that a lot of those ideas really, really should be taken to heart as to why we as a country really can't get things done, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, who was it? I think it was Bill Maher was complaining about it. He was just trying to put solar panels on his roof and the amount of just what do you call it? Red tape he had to go through to get it. Uh-huh. It was almost impossible. It took him 2 years or something like that. Wow. You shouldn't take that, you know? You should say, this looks like it'll be a good thing. Let's build a high-speed rail between L.A. and San Francisco, and then you just go ahead and build it, you know?
It should be speeded up because we need the energy, the clean energy.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it just, you know, I mean, if you had, for instance, good high-speed rail across the country, people would be taking that rather than airplanes. I mean, if there was a high-speed rail going from here to San Francisco, for instance, I would take it in a second instead of a plane because high-speed rail take about 36 hours to get across the country, if that. And in that case, hell, have a good time. Relax on the train. Have your meals on the train. Get yourself a Pullman. Sleep on the train. And then you get to San Francisco and you've had a nice little relaxing time. But no.
But everything's gone by you at four times the speed.
It doesn't look like that. I've been on high-speed railroads in Europe. And you would think that when you're going 125 miles an hour, everything would just be a blur outside. No. No. It looks very nice. I'm sorry.
I was thinking a much higher speed.
A 200 would still look fine.
Some of that is they have to find a way to make it more not only accessible but affordable. Because every time I research Amtrak, you know, and we talk all the time about, okay, well, we will take, you know, we would like to take a train for several days and all that. But it's extremely expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, crazy what they want to, I mean, they literally, I've looked before. I mean, if you want a sleeper car to go from like where we live, which you can't leave from Columbus, you'd either have to go to Akron or Cleveland or Cincinnati. Just go to like DC. First of all, they make the trip, which is 7 hours by car, into like 15 hours, which is fine. I get that's the way it has to be. But if you do want a sleeper car for that, I mean, the cost per person is like $800 or $900 per person.
Yeah.
And you have to leave. You have to depart at like 3 o'clock in the morning. That's the only departure time they have. Because so it's just like I don't know. I mean, I understand some of that might get fixed if they had more accessibility and availability. You know, because it would expand the service and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what they want to do about, you know, the price. I mean, don't get me wrong. I get that if you want to go from you know, Dover, Delaware to D.C., which maybe is like a 90-minute ride, and you can buy a coach seat, and it's, you know, maybe that costs $40 or whatever. Okay, I get people do that. But every time I've ever looked for anything that was, you know, any distance at all, I mean, the cost is just, I mean, it's 10 times what we would pay for fuel. I mean, 20 times.
Yeah, the fuel costs are what it is. The diesel fuel is ridiculous.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, we can probably drive to D.C. and back for probably, seriously, $100 in gas. It's a seven-hour trip from where I live. I mean, I'm trying to think. I mean, it's probably, let's call it three tanks. So maybe 125. Even if it's 150.
That's one tank for us.
Right. You know, but I'm just saying, I mean, even if it's, you know, $150, I mean, it's just, but I've looked before in like a round trip for us. I mean, I'm like, that's more than we're going to spend if we just drive down there and walk around for a couple days.
Well, the other thing I've never been able to figure out, and that is the actual speed that it goes. I took a trip to Boston, okay? And I went, okay, I love being on the train. Man, this is nice. I can spread out. Nice table in front of me, you know. It's a nice atmosphere, right? Except the train took forever to get up there. And I finally asked the conductor, and I said, whatever happened to high-speed rail as a notion in this country? And he said, every one of these trains that you're on going to Boston or down to Philadelphia or whatever are capable of high speeds. It's the rails that aren't capable of the high speeds. They've never put in the rails to take care of it. If they redid the rails, you'd be zipping down there in no time.
Yeah, right. And there are a lot of municipalities that limit the speeds that trains can pass through.
Yep.
You know, and things like that, too.
But those are the things that the Department of Transportation were supposed to be fixing over the last, well, since Trump was in his first term.
Yeah.
I mean they can do it. I know that they also got issues with the you know, like you said, the rails are not good enough for that. And if you look at some of the reports and some of these derailments, the maintenance on the rails themselves is pretty rough. There's a lot of track and they don't do a lot of good maintenance.
Well, supposedly,
that's why they're slowing all the hazmat down and everything else.
Well, supposedly Amtrak was supposed to be a high-speed rail system.
Yeah, it was.
Well, I got news for you.
And it would be nice if they could, you know, electrify it or something like that. Or an alternate fuel instead of diesel, because diesel is just
In Japan.
I buy it every day.
In Japan, I believe they don't use – what do they use? Do they use hydro? Is it something? What do they use in Japan? They have very fast railroads there.
Well, they have a lot of nuclear power there.
No, but it isn't. They aren't nuclear powered trains.
Well, I mean the electricity, you know.
Yeah,
electrified trains for sure.
Oh, I know what it is. It's, how do I explain it? It's rails that change. How can I put it? They kind of change.
Like electromagnetic.
It's electromagnetic. That's what I was looking for. And what it does, maglev, right. And it turns on and off, on and off, on and off. What it's doing is it's pushing the train.
Right.
Yeah, it has
more. They have some of those in China.
Yeah. But
China has the run
that, you know, it's. That can generate a lot of power and good torque from, you know, low energy or whatever. I mean, the new aircraft carriers, for example, no longer launch planes by steam catapult. They use electromagnetic.
Well, Marjorie took a high-speed train from Beijing down to Shanghai.
And she said it was fast. It was really fast.
So it's mostly electric for all these trains.
Josh brought up an interesting point. Yeah, we're going away from steam catapults to maglev, right on the ship.
Right.
You know, it's a lot less dangerous for the people around the aircraft, unless you get hit by the aircraft. But you know, but it's a lot faster and a lot more efficient than steam.
And I should add that, Caltrain over in the peninsula is completely electrified now.
Yeah,
and that's a far high speed rail, and I love it. I take my bicycle on it. I used to, you know, before the old trains, I'd have to carry them up the steps, and now it's just like the car, the floor of the car, is about that high from the platform. Just wheel the bicycle, and a lot of people take bikes on Caltrain. They have special cars that people can take their bicycles on.
Yep.
Great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Almost like BART. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have any fast transportation, do you, Bree, in Malaysia?
They're talking about it, but I have been on the ones in China.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they are talking. They
have the ones in China are new, aren't they? I mean, they're more recent.
Yeah.
No?
Well,
Marjorie took one, as I say, that went down to, I think, Shanghai. And she said
I took one from the airport in Shanghai, close to downtown Shanghai.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I've ridden that a couple times. But that's been there, at least 10, 15 years.
Yeah, but that's a short trip. I'm talking about a trip from Beijing to Shanghai. That was pretty new when she went on it.
Yeah. Definitely, there's a bunch. They have a whole mapping. But they have some issues because some of the land has permafrost and it's been defrosting, I guess, or whatever. So they're having some issues with laying the track as fast as they want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they did have a deal here between Singapore and Malaysia. And then they were also talking about one between KL and Bangkok, and they wanted to go Singapore, Bangkok, Bangkok, Singapore. But the problem is Singaporeans have the money, but it would only be like 1 kilometer inside Singapore, but it would be, you know, 500 kilometers in KL. So that Malaysia would have to pay a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the deal broke down, something like that, but they definitely should get it. I'm really in favor of it, but there's just so many other options. We have really cheap, budget airlines here. You can go all around this region for $100.
Really?
There's so many budget airlines. I lose track of them. And then there's bus lines.
Well, I notice you taking the bus a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's because it's so convenient. It's, you know, I used to take Greyhound back in the day in the States. I haven't been there and I haven't ridden Greyhound in 20 years, so I don't know if I would. There was something called Megabus for a while too.
Yeah, they still go.
Yeah.
And they got a bulk bus that goes from here to LA.
Is it okay?
I think they buy their whole buses from Greyhound.
Wow.
And Greyhound, the ones that I've seen, yeah, you used to look at Greyhound buses and go, those are nice buses. Now they're kind of, yeah, I guess I can get to San Francisco on that for a
while. We may not have fast railroads here, but we do have tall flagpoles at the White House now. So
that block the vision of the White House.
And by the way, that hurt the helicopters trying to land on the lawn.
No, he said everything yesterday. He told them, we looked at all that, and this is where they told us to put them because they would be clear. But I think he put that to the inch.
But anyway, I mean, I just don't know why high speed rail transportation or high speed transportation in general hasn't really caught on here. You know, we love our cars so much and we love being stalled in traffic so much that we want to live with that and celebrate that as being our form of transportation.
I know you guys probably talked about it, but you know the bullet train that they've been trying to build. here, L.A. to San Francisco.
I was talking about that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I see it all the time. I go down to Fresno area, and there's just these huge sections and supports, and nothing is done. I watched this one right
they
at Herndon.
They stopped building it, didn't
at Her- No, it was still going. Herndon Road, they had a bridge there that was less than a quarter mile, probably a quarter mile, going over the river. And that thing, I know it took at least 8 years to build it.
Yeah.
I'm going, what the hell? And then they build all these trestles all along the way, and they don't connect them.
Well, what's this thing,
Kevin, I was just going to say earlier, I was mentioning that this book, Abundance, by Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson. And a lot of the problem, unfortunately,
by the way, he's selling those on Yamaguchi.com.
Right, exactly. I'm selling books. Anyway, but it's a great book. And the idea is he's talking about an abuse of the CEQA, the California Environmental Quality
Act.
Yes,
CEQA is a pain, yeah.
Yeah, and it's also a reason why we have such a terrible housing shortage. So,
right.
Yeah, Chance, I'd suggest you read that book. It's really good.
Check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the name of it again?
Abundance.
Oh, okay. I'll find it that way.
Yeah, I never understood it, Alex, because...
What?
Got it.
What were you going to say, Bree?
I used to also take Amtrak, and I love the trains, you know, and I wish they had high-speed rail. I guess it comes down to who has the better lobbying. You know, and Amtrak was kind of always state government-ish, and the airlines and the buses are privatized. I don't know, but I just...
When I went up to Boston, I sat in the train and I went, this is wonderful, this is comfortable. Now if it would only go faster, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw cars passing us on the road.
Yeah, but I mean, but that's the thing. If you plan accordingly, this is my big beef. I haven't had a car in 20 years. If you plan your life correctly, and it depends on where you are. I understand that, but mm-hmm. for many people, you don't need a car. You have to be mobile. You have to be not tied to...
I haven't had a car in 20 years.
Yeah.
You know.
I haven't had a car in 40 years.
Oh, really? Oh, well, you use a bike, right?
Yeah, and bus and BART.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can get around over in the East Bay and that's right. Down where I'm at, nothing. Nothing. We got to drive at least 15 miles to get to the bottom of Caltrain. Right, mm-hmm. Gilroy, where it starts.
Yeah.
That's okay. 30 miles right off the bat.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, I just found I haven't driven in almost 20 years. I gave up my cars when I left California. And I've had no reason to buy another one. You know, why? I buy a car here, and I'd park it in a parking lot, the garage, at $700 a month, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and let's see here. The insurance on the car here would be a living hell. And then, how many times would I use that car? You know.
And then you could have a car like your friend Walter Sabo, the engine light's always on.
Yes, right.
The
right.
Check engine light's always on.
Yeah, well, I mean, but I, you know, I mean, I would love to have a car. I don't know if I know how to drive anymore, to be honest with you. I have driven a car when I've rented them. But the last time I think I drove a car was 7 years ago. So I don't even know if I can drive them anymore. You know, so and I shouldn't have to have one. I should be able to run down to Grand Central Station, hop on a train, and be down Washington, D.C. in a half an hour, 45 minutes.
It'll take you at least that long to run down there.
Well, yes, that's true. You know,
I think for a lot of people, if there's a high-speed rail, you have to go to the station. You know, and they might think, well, how am I going to get there? I got to drive. Well, if I have a car, then I might as well just drive everywhere, you know.
Yeah, but that's if you live in a place like Kevin does, where you have to drive to the train. Here, you just simply take a car down there, a subway or whatever, go to Grand Central Station and grab a train, you know. Marjorie was suggesting that we take a train across Canada. I hear that's kind of nice, you know.
I've heard those are very good.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a nice way to travel, but like Josh was saying, it is very expensive.
It is expensive.
Yeah.
It's a great way to travel. I mean, I know somebody that took one from down here, probably out of San Jose, and up to, I think it was Portland or somewhere up in northern Oregon. And it was almost 40 hours, 36 hours, something like that.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
Yes.
That's a nice drive.
It's an hour and a half in the air.
Huh?
Considering it's an hour and a half in the air.
Yeah. Or 9 hours in the car.
But the Coast Starlight is probably the most scenic train trips you could take. I mean,
you got all the time in the world. It's a great way to go. And they're expensive.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Josh was saying.
Yeah.
Not cheap. I took one from the Bay Area to Los Angeles. It took me 14 hours to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And it cost me double what it would have cost me to rent a car and drive it there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but it was beautiful.
Okay. Yeah. Let me change the subject slightly here for a second about what's happening with our president has now said he's going to make a decision in 2 weeks.
No, he's not. He says that's his general, what he says when he wants to delay coverage. Because he knows by that time, every cycle will have changed. So, no, it doesn't.
Well, to begin with, doesn't that problem need attention now? You know? Yes, yeah. Alan.
If Trump wants to screw with Iraq... Iran. Why doesn't he go be president down there for a while?
Okay.
Sorry.
Anyway,
Trump is very good.
He tries to kick the can down the road.
Yeah, he's good at detecting where the media is going. And they're building on this. Is he going to make this decision? He's got to make this decision. Is it? And then all the, you know, pundits and everybody. So then he can address it without addressing it. And then it's like, okay. Well, two weeks. Okay. And then the next day they move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like whenever he wants to change the directive of the framing, that's what he says. He said it hundreds of times.
It appears to me that in 2 weeks there may be no Israel left or no Iran left or neither of them left. You know? I mean, isn't this something that demands your immediate attention? Instead, what we've got is a president who's incapable of being a wartime president.
He doesn't want to participate.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, would you agree with my feeling on that, Josh, that he's really not a very good – I never trusted that he would be a good war president, would he?
Well, I don't think he's very capable of much personally. You know, they send a lot of mixed messages, you know, not only in their words but, you know, through their actions, you know. The situation is so dire and is so urgent that I have to leave the G7, where he probably doesn't want to be anyway. Mm-hmm. I have to leave tonight because it's so urgent. And then he comes back and nothing happens. Yeah. And now we're not going to do anything for 2 weeks. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's always like this sort of thing with them. You know, 48 hours ago, it was so urgent. We had to leave one of the most important meetings that happens every, you know, year. We just up and leave because it's so important, and now we don't need to do anything for 2 weeks. So, you know, which is it? Now, I know they say that, well, it'll be 2 weeks to allow for the diplomatic process, right? Well, a couple hours before he said that, it doesn't do any good to negotiate with these people. They just negotiate in bad faith. Everything they say is a lie. If we make a deal with him, it doesn't matter. As soon as we leave the room, they'll just ignore the deal, which I don't necessarily disagree with. That is how they operate. But, you know, I mean, that's what I'm saying. He says all that, and this is all we'll have to wait for 2 weeks. I guess
it was 60 days, and this is the 61st day.
Now, yeah, all of a sudden, I mean, you know, what I see from Trump here is just the normal situation where he talks out of both faces that he has, and one always contradicts the other. None of it makes any sense.
Well, isn't this the same guy? Up. The same guy that in his last administration took a deal that Obama had created for them to stop making, making
enrichment,
doing enrichment and building a bomb, and then Trump comes into office and turns it all down. And now,
because Obama's name was on it, that's all.
Yeah, and now he's trying to get it to work again. He wants to make a deal. Well, you had deal, you putz.
It's he certainly creates some of these problems on his own. I mean, you would never get himself or sadly his party to admit that. And Democrats are not nearly as good at hammering that over his head as Republicans are with other presidents. So, you know, the issue just kind of slides by and nobody really notices it. But, you know, he's also supposed to have had this genius guy that worked for him, this real estate guy, the Wyckoff or whatever, supposed to go around and solve all these problems. Remember, he was going to solve the Ukraine-Russia thing. And then as soon as he was done with that, he was going to move on and take care of, you know, the Iran issue and the Israel thing and, you know, the North Korea thing was going to get. So, I mean, that guy's obviously, you know, I've heard some stories about that and seen some articles where they say, you know, that guy literally has no clue what's going on in the world, that he's completely disconnected from reality. So, you know, it's just sort of what happens when you have a weak president. In my opinion, he's very weak. I know they like to paint it the other side, but that's all bluster. When you take that away, there's not much substance to his foreign policies because he doesn't really have a foreign policy. He just gets up in the morning and sees what's happening and, you know, goes along with whatever he thinks will play well that day for the media and for people, and that's not foreign policy, you know. So, but when you take that and you surround it with people that are not very qualified for the job, they're not of the highest intelligence, the highest character, things like that. This surprises what you get. I mean, I didn't read the article, but I saw some headline today that said, you know, he's in a bad spot with Tulsi Gabbard now. She seems disconnected from the administration and, in a couple of weeks, he'll probably fire her, you know, I mean, and then blame all this stuff on her, you know what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah.
So it's like,
basically, the Gabbard story was that, what he was asked about the fact that Gabbard had testified that Iran wasn't anywhere near close to getting a nuclear weapon, his response was, I don't care what she thinks. I believe this instead.
She doesn't know what you're talking about.
So he just like dismissed his own person that he hired to advise him on national security. You know, like he did with Bolton in the previous administration. So why even bother hiring these people if you're not going to listen to them?
She was hired, as are most of them, because he thinks they look good in a particular position and or they will create a kerfuffle that he can, you know, a hornet's nest that he can poke anytime he needs to divert and change the story. And that's all it is. Every time a story comes up he doesn't like, he goes over and pokes another hornet's nest. So he doesn't like the Musk-Trump storylines. Doesn't like to get asked about that, so he just goes over, pokes another one, you know, and it's the same. I mean, if you look at Israel was getting, the attention was on Gaza, and the overwhelming majority of sort of the court of public opinion was shifting against Israel. And so by lobbing some missiles over at Iran, they've completely changed the narrative. Now you've got the foreign minister or leader of Germany saying, yeah, they're doing the dirty work for the world for us. And it's completely changed the media's attention. And it's really remarkable if you think about it. How many voices have you heard from Jordan, from Iraq, even from Iran. None whatsoever. Most of the coverage, even if you watch YouTube clips, it all comes from the global mm-hmm. North and a Western perspective. And it's quite amazing. I get to hear bits and pieces from the other sides because of where I live. But I, follow the media mm-hmm. in all over the world, actually. But basically, if you watch, it's just amazing when you watch CNN and how watch an hour of CNN and watch an hour of Al Jazeera and English. Mm-hmm. Al Jazeera English blows CNN away. It's not even on the same level. The kinds of stories you get, the kinds of information you get, is just completely different. And I just see most of the Western news outlets are just propaganda. It's just completely bought and paid for.
Mm-hmm.
Just in my two cents.
Well, what happens is, what I see happening here with mm-hmm. the media is, for instance, let's say Netanyahu says, blah, 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 they're within 3 days of having a nuclear device. And then we're supposed to take that as the absolute truth. It's not anywhere near that. There may be within a couple of weeks of being able to make fissionable material, but that doesn't mean they're going to be able to to make a bomb. And making a bomb, it's a big difference between getting the fissionable material up and then making the bomb. It's more to make the bomb. It takes time, Ask Oppenheimer. It wasn't easy.
Yeah, and I also think that if they make it seem like it seems to me that shooting the breeze. If I were in the Iranian shoes, I'd be like, we better make sure we get a nuclear missile now. Because we're definitely under threat here all the time. Mm-hmm. And hey, look at North Korea. They've got a nuclear weapon and nobody's attacking them,
Right.
So I think they look around.
I'm surprised that
North Korea hasn't said, hey, Iran, how about we give you a nuke?
Here's the part that was amazing to me. Did you see where Trump did one of his little tweets on his thing on Truth Social. And he said, we know where the Ayatollah is right now.
Right.
But we're not going to bomb him.
Yeah.
Are you going to, if you know where he is, are you going to post that you know where he is so he can move out really fast? that just amazes me the way he keeps tipping his hat. Of course he doesn't know where the Ayatollah is, okay? when he gives a speech, maybe he's in downtown Iran, whatever, I don't know. But, to make a post like that in which you're tipping your hat. Where he is. It's stupid. Just stupid.
Well, why would we?
It's not stupid.
What were you going to say, Josh?
Well, I was just going to say, I don't understand. Why would we, the Americans, under his own foreign policy declarations,
mm-hmm.
choose to eliminate, the Ayatollah? Basically through political assassination. If you view him as a legitimate military target, as the head of their military, which is a reasonable assumption. Mm-hmm. I know several respected military analysts in the United States that would agree he would be a military target, but mm-hmm. that it would come with extreme retaliation. Why would we, the Americans, choose to do that for a measure of actions that the Israelis started and under Trump's own foreign policy declarations and campaigns has proclaimed as unnecessary, not necessary for our security, as something that he's vowed to keep us out. I mean, why would we be the ones that want to do it?
Mm-hmm.
If Israel chose to do it, that would be Israel's prerogative. They are a sovereign nation. They could do so and then suffer the consequences thereof. But why would we?
Yeah.
Well, and one of the other narratives was, well, only the U.S. has the bunker-busting bomb, and only the U.S. has the plane that can fly it in. Well, in Trump's world, there's an easy way around that. Israel, would you like to borrow a plane and a bomb? Okay, it's yours for 24 hours. Give it back to us later.
Have fun.
You know what I mean? He can just say, well, it's not us. We loaned it to them. I don't know what they'd do with it.
My understanding, from people that I would trust, including Admiral Stavridis, is that us loaning them our aircraft or our bomb is completely out of the question. You know, they do not have the training to operate the aircraft or deploy, the bomb, et cetera. I mean, you know, that if this were to happen, it has to be a completely American operation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my whole thing is, if it happens, and whether you support it or not, you know, it's fine. I see it as a different subject. What I see is happening is that Netanyahu decided that he wanted to do it, and that he began a campaign knowing that when they got to the last step, the only way to finish the campaign would be for the Americans to do it, and he did it anyway, therefore sort of blackmailing or ultimatum, type of deal to Trump, that he has to do it, and all you hear about Trump is, oh, it's just, he just leads through so much strength, and he's so strong and respected, he's so strong and respected that he tells Netanyahu not to do this, and Netanyahu doesn't go anyway, and then says, "Oh, I know they'll have to come do it because they've already come." So, I mean, he basically tricks him into it because he knows he doesn't believe that he'll call his bluff. So we'll see.
Last night, Alan, when I said that, that Netanyahu made the first strike. You came back saying, oh, no, wasn't it Iran? Well, the way it looks right now with all the stuff coming back is that, it's Iran's fault. But no, Iran didn't send the first bomb over there.
Yeah, we were talking about Gaza 2 seconds before, and that's what I thought you meant, Gaza.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but still, you get the feeling that it's Iran who made the attack. They haven't done anything except respond now in kind. And by the way, Israel is running out of rockets to defend themselves of that Iron Dome. That Iron Dome is only good for so long, before you run out of rockets to shoot back up.
Yeah, well, I thought they were doing it with microwaves.
No.
I'm kidding.
Well, that was their choice.
Jewish space lasers, right?
Jewish space lasers.
That's right. Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Jewish space lasers.
I mean, they made the choice.
That's a better line.
They made the choice to partake in this. It's just what my thing is, I'm not necessarily against ending a nuclear program for the Iranians either, but I think that, and even if this works, I mean, that's fine, but the risk of the way that they went about it, which is sort of just make it up as they go along between Netanyahu and Trump, two of the least trustful people on the planet Earth right now, of this generation even, is not a wise decision, if you ask me. I mean, such an operation, really, if we really wanted to do it in the way that they did, should have been planned out among the two nations at the highest level with all the possible contingencies, for a number of months now. And what will be incredibly sad, even if it, is if we get to this point now and he does commit American might to the program. And again, I might even support the fact that, they could accomplish this mission, but let's not act like our planes cannot be shot down or that we can't lose a pilot in this. I mean, they could just have an accident on the way, right? You know, I mean, you know, these things happen. Anytime you put people in the field, in service, something can happen. Mm-hmm. And if something like that were to happen now, I'd hate to think that it could have been avoided had they, you know, actually operated the way that past administrations in both nations have done. And what they've done here is they've skipped all that, and they've just, they act like it all just snuck up on them, you know, when I mean,
well,
that,
you know,
what the Israelis did is that didn't have to be that way.
I hate to sound like a broken record, but I've kept bringing up the fact that why should Iran not have a nuclear device? Because everybody else in the world does, and they've all got their nuclear devices aimed at them.
If they
had one, we would be a little more careful about the kind of rhetoric we have and the kind of actions we take.
I think the point behind that one, you know, is I don't think they're... I mean, there is obviously worry about an untrustful, bad-acting nation like Iran having one large nuclear weapon that they could launch on the Israelis, for example, but I don't think that's their true worry. I think the true worry is if you have the technology to build that, then you obviously will have the technology and the capability to build many smaller, more tactical-style weapons that Iran can then give to people who are way even worse than they are, right? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They can give a small tactical nuclear weapon to someone like Hamas, for example, who may not hesitate, probably would not hesitate at all to deploy it on Israelis or even Americans somewhere.
Yeah.
Or an American military base. Where they can, I mean, they can do damage from 10 miles away.
Yeah, but so can any one of a dozen other countries. And yet they don't, because everybody's, once they got the bomb, they're afraid to use it because they know that the rest of the world will unleash the bomb on them.
Assured mutual destruction is a doctrine that has kept these things from being deployed for a very long time, but I will say that is among nation states. Among terrorist organizations, assured mutual destruction is not nearly as feared as it is among nation states.
Right.
You know, I mean, suicide bombers are not particularly worried about mutual destruction.
These two countries are really just taking their youngsters so to treat them so that when they get to be 20 years ago, they can still continue to kill with the other group. There's no solutions here.
I mean,
that's absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah.
They can delay it, mm-hmm. but you can't stop education. They're going to have the willpower.
Yeah.
Also, don't forget the leader is like 90 years old. Like taking him out.
He's 87.
And don't 88
or 87. You're talking about Iran?
Yeah, I think he's 88 or 89.
It might be closer to 88. Yeah.
So, I mean, he's only got a couple of years anyway.
Yeah, so, you know.
I have to say, there's a reason why we have a nuclear non-proliferation treaty. And that's it. As Vernon Dunn brought up last time we talked about it.
Well,
but Josh's point is right on target.
Oh, let's say what?
Which is what?
Which is, well, what Josh just said. He just said that terrorist organizations, it doesn't apply to them.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, we can argue. We can argue. Tomorrow night, we'll argue what is a terrorist organization, okay? Because a terrorist usually is someone else's freedom fighter. So anyway, you know, it's a matter of semantics. We are running out of time here, and I thank you all for a very interesting hour here. Thank you to Josh for having joined us tonight, and thanks to Alan for being here. You know, Tom, you're welcome here anytime, okay? In spite of the fact you're just here to sell books. And thanks, Jeff. And thanks to Kevin, by the way. And finally, to Bree, who's over there in Malaysia. Thank you very much, Bree. Everybody give a big wave goodbye, and I'll give a big wave goodbye at you, okay? There they go, ladies and gentlemen. That's our citizen panel for tonight. There'll be another one getting together in just a moment over there on Amy's show. The intersection, they'll be taking your calls, and you go to gabnet.net, and you go to the third column down, the very bottom, it says Alex Bennett, it says Amy Manuel. You click on Amy Manuel, and that way you'll be able to call her on her Zoom. I'll see you again tomorrow night, same time, same station in life. In the meantime, as always, if you see her, tell her I love her, okay? Bye-bye, everybody.